This is Wake Up Call.
Another kind of daytime radio program.
On the Sports Map Radio Network.
All right, let's do this.
Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
Good morning. Thanks for joining us as we continue to progress forward to the AFC and NFC championship games. We've got drama in Dallas we want to get to. We will talk about Patrick Mahomes, Lamar Jackson, Brock Purdy, Jared Goff, quarterbacks at the center of leading their team in a way of a legacy. We will get to that, but we want to start, and I want to start this hour by talking some NBA, because the Milwaukee Bucks have fired their head coach, Adrian Griffin. Adrian Griffin was a rookie head coach, but he had been an assistant coach in the league for a long time. But he was hired after the team had fired Mike Budenholzer last year after a first-round exit to the Miami Heat. Now, if you remember that series against Miami, Giannis was hurt and came back, and they never really found a rhythm. They never made the kind of adjustments that they were supposed to make. Maybe they took Miami too lightly, thinking Giannis's return would help them get back into the series. They made some defensive mistakes, which is a little odd because Budenholzer is a very smart defensive coach. Nevertheless, at the end, when you win the Eastern Conference and have the number one seed and you are exited out of the team that went through the play-in tournament, you're going to get out, and Mike Budenholzer was fired. So they were looking for a new head coach. Now, Adrian Griffin had interviewed 14 different times to be a head coach in the NBA, and was never hired. He stayed an assistant, and Giannis felt like Adrian Griffin was the kind of coach that they would want, and so they hired him. And they wanted Nick Nurse, but there was some internal conversations about whether or not Nurse would actually work. Make no mistake here, Giannis wanting Adrian Griffin was the reason that Milwaukee hired Adrian Griffin. The Bucks are 30-13. That's a good record. They're right behind Boston in the Eastern Conference standings at number two. But they can't play defense. They're a terrible defensive team. They're ranking in the bottom half of the defensive categories, some as low as 27, if you really want to look into all the different defensive metrics that the NBA has. And they are smart enough as a team and smart enough as an organization to know that despite the fact that they're 30-13, and like one of their games was won on a near half-court buzzer beater, they've lost to teams that they feel like they were better at. Remember, they lost to Indiana in the in-season tournament, and they were actually kind of upset about it, but a lot of their anger was quietly and sort of signaling at head coach Adrian Griffin. And Milwaukee realized, you know what, even if we're 30-13, even if we're kind of 3.5 games back of the Celtics in the East, we're not a good basketball team when it comes to playoff basketball. We're not a good basketball team that in a 7-game series, we can't keep going through these offensive outputs to sort of cover up for the fact that we don't play very good defense. Bad defensive teams usually get out of the postseason rather quickly. And so they realized that they have now needed to make a change. There's a lot of internal soap opera drama that's gone on with the Bucks, and a lot of it has to do with Giannis sort of pulling the strings. He wanted Adrian Griffin until he didn't want Adrian Griffin. And that is basically where people are kind of angling this story, in that this is the guy he wanted, and then he realized, you know, midway through the season, this isn't the guy he wanted, and now the Milwaukee Bucks have made a change. There are reports that Doc Rivers is likely to get this job. I don't know why the Milwaukee Bucks want Doc Rivers, except he did play at Marquette, and, you know, there is some love for Milwaukee towards Doc Rivers. But remember, this is the same Doc Rivers that blew two playoff 3-1 leads. Right, this is the same Doc Rivers that couldn't get the Clippers any further. They couldn't get the Sixers further, despite winning a championship with the Boston Celtics at the time when Boston had their big three. So, again, what the Milwaukee Bucks want is a championship now. They went all in on getting Damian Lillard, but it cost them. We said it at the time. I was a little blown away by that deal. I can understand wanting to get Damian Lillard. But they gave up one of the best defensive players in the league in Drew Holiday, especially on the perimeter. And they lost him out in the deal. So while offensively, the Giannis-Damian Lillard combination has been fun to watch at times, it's fun to sort of follow him along as Giannis gets a double-double or a triple-double, or Damian Lillard scores 41 points or whatever. But defensively, they have sacrificed that, because Damian Lillard is not a good defensive player, especially in transition. So this was a been, again, a kind of a soap opera-esque a change of the guard in Milwaukee. It's one of those stories that comes as a surprise, and then you kind of go, now I see why it's not a surprise. But it is a surprise when a team that's 30-13 is firing their head coach, especially when he's a rookie head coach in his first year. Because you don't want to look like you've really made a mistake until everybody knows you've made a mistake. Like, if this, again, if this was Mike Budenholzer that survived the early exit and they were 30-13 and there was something wrong and there was something missing and there was some aspect of the Milwaukee Bucks game, you could say, all right, we're making a change. It's a change for the better. This is not a team right now that can win. They went out and hired a guy nobody else wanted to be a head coach. Again, he interviewed 14 different times, and no one hired him. And he's a former player in the league, and he's tough. But the one issue, you could tell this wasn't working early, because when they got Damian Lillard, Terry Stotts was hired, the former Portland Trailblazers head coach. And a lot of it was to sort of be around Damian Lillard, right? Coach Damian Lillard his whole career, practically. And Stotts left in September, before the season even started. There was so much conflict between a guy in Adrian Griffin as a rookie head coach with a guy on his staff that not only was a head coach, somewhat successful head coach, and was the coach of the new star that was arriving in Milwaukee to go up against the other star that has owned Milwaukee in Giannis Antetokounmpo. So there was already tension that was built in anyway. But it has not been a good behind-the-scenes aspect for the Milwaukee Bucks, a team that right now, I mean, came off a championship a couple of years ago, was on a championship run during the regular season last year, really looked like a team that could get it all, could take it all. And then they were taken out by the Miami Heat in the first round in one of the more shocking first-round upsets. I mean, even given the back problems that Giannis had in the postseason. Remember, that Miami Heat team really blew everybody away, because it wasn't the Miami getting like the traditional 8 seed where they might have been pretty good, but they got in. They had to go through the play-in tournament, and they lost their first play-in game, which means they played their second play-in game with their backs to the wall and then finally got in when they emerged from the tournament. And then was, you know, had to face Milwaukee and beat them in 5 games. I mean, Milwaukee was never in that series. And again, it cost Budenholzer his job. It required an outstanding basketball team to be looking for a new head coach. And instead of settling on somebody with experience or maybe a championship pedigree, they went with a rookie head coach. Guy had never been a head coach before, to take over a team that was now acquiring Damian Lillard and had to look a lot different than they had before. Right, we're not going to be the same tough defensive Milwaukee Bucks team. We're going to try to beat you 137-131. And that doesn't work in the postseason. It just doesn't. Yeah, it's fine. We're looking at the NFL, right? And I was bringing this up yesterday. Defense is such a critical part of sports. It gets overlooked because offense is shiny and fun, and that's the highlight, and that's everything that you want. Right? Everybody wants the high-flying offense. Everybody wants the 40-point football games. Defense is what is going to keep you alive. It's not so much defense wins championships like a cliche. You need an offense too. But it is an integral part of how you get success in sports. And in this case, like in the NFL, as we talked about yesterday, of the 4 teams, you have the top 3 scoring defenses in the NFL still in the playoffs. And in the NBA, it is very hard to get through a 7-game series, especially when the opponents get tougher and tougher and tougher, if your defense is lacking. Yeah, Boston, I remember when Marcus Smart's a good defensive player. I was thinking that could hurt, but they picked up Drew Holiday, so in the deal. But in Milwaukee's case, they knew that they were not good enough to beat Boston. Heck, they weren't good enough to beat Indiana. They can see the writing on the wall, and they had to make a change. Now, that is smart to me. Again, very smart. And this isn't a Milwaukee Bucks team that is, 15-18, right? I mean, this isn't how in the world is that happening? And, you know, how are they the 9th seed in the East? Where did this go wrong? And they're making a change. They're making a change when they're near the top of the conference, when they have one of the better records in the NBA, because they are looking down the road and they're saying, this is all nonsense. We see this a lot in teams in these long seasons, like the NBA and sometimes even in Major League Baseball, where they know they're good, they know they're fine, just get us to the postseason and we'll be okay. The NBA goes through these, you know, you get these ups and downs where everyone wants to know what's wrong with Denver because they lost three in a row, or what's wrong with the Celtics because they lost four or five. Nothing. Get me to April and we'll see what happens. Get me when the seven-game series starts and then try to beat me four out of seven. Milwaukee saw that and went, a lot of teams are going to beat us four out of seven. And that's why they made this change. But it's still, there's a lot of cool, again, soap opera kind of stories and anecdotes between that went on behind the scenes here. Players calling out the coach without directly calling out the coach on certain nights throughout the season. It's kind of a not necessarily a deep dive into the drama behind the Milwaukee Bucks, but it was worthy of note because, again, they made the big news yesterday in firing Adrian Griffin, a coach that probably shouldn't have been hired in the first place. But there is only one explanation for it that most people have come across, is that, one, Giannis really, really, really saw the writing on the wall and asked that this be done. When they lost to Indiana, they were really angry, and they weren't angry because a banner wasn't going to go up in the rafters, you know, like the Lakers put up a banner. They weren't mad because they lost an in-season tournament championship run in the semifinals. No, they were mad because what they saw was, and what they felt like they were not a team capable of making a championship run in the postseason. They knew their weaknesses. They tried different things, but those things got exploited. Griffin wasn't listening to a lot of the players saying, hey, this is not working. This is not working. He was sticking to his guns on a defensive formula that was just not going to be effective down the road. So again, good big story yesterday in the NBA. But when we come back, there's even a bigger story in Dallas. What is going on with family drama for the Cowboys, and why are these players not ripping apart the Twitter accounts of relatives that are making a mess of the situation in Dallas? We'll get to that coming up next. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Call on the Sports Map Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. Hit us up on Twitter at Tony D Radio, at Ron Culver. That is Ron with two N's. Ron and I were just having a little fun conversation before the show about the doomsday clock, which is at 90 seconds. Yep. I don't even know what the doomsday clock is. I don't even know how they figured it out. But don't you think in Dallas the doomsday clock is like at 4 seconds to midnight?
Three.
Maybe three.
Two, one.
What a mess. So the doomsday clock is one of these theoretical things where scientists go, hey, we're close to Earth being uninhabited. And sometimes it's like 2 minutes to midnight. And sometimes it's 5 minutes to midnight when things are better. But now it's 90 seconds. And if it hits midnight, everybody's going
to
die.
Has it ever been 5 minutes to midnight?
Never. Because it's a money raising thing.
Was it ever like, you know, hey, we're 11 and a half hours to midnight. All things are good.
No, these scientists want you to feel like the end is near. So then when they say, we need money for this research or this thing or whatever it is, everyone gives them money because they're scared because the doomsday clock is approaching midnight. But in Dallas, the doomsday clock, their doomsday wouldn't be an uninhabitable Earth. Their doomsday would be completely irrelevant in the conversation of a Super Bowl championship. But boy, it's got to be close to midnight because now family members feel like it's open season on Dak Prescott and the Cowboys. And so now, if you have a relative that plays in professional sports, and maybe they're a close relative, maybe it's your kid, maybe it's your brother, maybe even it's a close cousin. Distant cousin, who cares? Just go nuts. But if you're a close relative of an athlete, don't you think you would think about that player and how they would have to deal with you if you were to tweet out stuff that got attention about a situation? I mean, like, for example, let's say my brother was playing in the NFL and I was mad at his circumstance. I would be careful what I put out on social media because somebody might catch it and go, hey, this is Phillip's brother, and here's what he's saying about his team situation and would get traction and would get steam. And then my brother would have to go to his teammates and go, my brother Tony's an idiot. He's an idiot and he doesn't know what he's talking about. And I don't support this. And you know what? I'm going to go talk to him about this because that's what he said was wrong. Blah, 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 blah. I'd make my life harder. Apparently, there's no filter on any of these Cowboy relatives for what they did on social media, ripping the team. And I know they're all emotional. I mean, after all, the team won 12 games and had a home game against the Packers and should have won. But it kind of started with CeeDee Lamb's mom. Because, and again, moms are moms. What are you going to do? There's really nothing you could do, right? When mom's mad, what are you going to do? You can tell your mom to be quiet. She was upset because she posted on Facebook, Dak isn't it. They need to get his bleep out of here. It's guys on the team that want a ring. They work too hard. He doesn't want to win a ring. That's a rather bold statement, don't you think?
Rather harsh.
That's harsh. Dak Prescott doesn't want to win a championship. Well, that's basically what she's implying.
What I want to know is, what is she basing this off of?
Right, right. Just, is it mama tears? Is that all it is?
Was it that Dak wasn't getting her boy the ball enough? Because as far as I know, there was only one wide receiver on the team.
That's right. Maybe it's just that that he threw the pick six, that he was ineffective, and that her son is not going to the Super Bowl. You know, not to, you know, or heading towards closer to getting to the Super Bowl. Right? Maybe she's just mad about that. But here's why this matters. You might say to yourself, oh, this is family drama. You know why it matters? Because it would be interesting if we knew what some of this was really based on, like you just mentioned. Because we all have had problems in our workplace, and we all share that with people we care about. Right? No matter where you work, what you do, chances are you've told your wife about your boss this or your supervisor that or a coworker this or a circumstance at your office that you're frustrated with, a meeting you had to go to that was not effective or a project you were on that got scrapped at the last minute, whatever it may be, right? And you tell your wife. Maybe you tell your brother. Maybe you tell the people at Thanksgiving dinner. Maybe you share some of your concerns with your job with people you care about. It's then those people taking that and that's how they're seeing you, right? They're not with you every day when you are chumming it up with your friends or you've patched that up with the coworker or that project that got scrapped came back and you're like kind of excited because it's going to return in 2024 at some point. Like they're not there daily. What they remember is you at Thanksgiving complaining about something or you at some family gathering and you've made it clear that you're unhappy with this, 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 or this. And you thought as a person, you thought it was kind of safe. And for many of us, we're not in high profile enough jobs to make it a big deal. But if you're a Cowboys player and you've shared with family members that you struggle with the coaching staff or you struggle with this or your quarterback that or whatever it may be, some of that's got to be like if CeeDee Lamb said to his mother that Dak Prescott's the greatest human being he's ever known, that he wouldn't want to catch footballs from anybody other than Dak Prescott. Do you think she would have wrote that? Do you think she would have wrote that, honestly? Because I don't think so. I think there was something that she knows about her son and his thoughts on the quarterback that allowed him to do. She's saying Dak Prescott doesn't want to win a championship. She might have met him. You know, chances are they've run, you know, she's there with her son. Maybe they run into each other. But she's posting out something like that. Now we can just dismiss it. But I'm wondering if it's coming from some other place. I'm wondering if it's coming from something she knows about her son's relationship with Dak Prescott. But that wasn't it, right? Because she was getting into it with people responding to that comment. But that wasn't it. Micah Parsons' brother, he got into the act too. He criticized Dan Quinn. He also said Dak Prescott needs to take a team-friendly deal or get out of town. It is open season on Dak Prescott from the relatives of his teammates. And, of course, Micah Parsons, realizing the damage that this could cause, came right out and said, as you know, if I have something to say, I'm not afraid to say it. I love my team, my brothers on my team, and the city of Dallas, and I'm more committed than ever to bring a championship to the greatest fan base on earth. He's doing damage control for his brother. because his brother again felt like it's open season. Look, social media has allowed this to come out when it was always there to begin with. Let's make that very, very clear, right? Before there was Twitter, before there was Facebook, believe me, relatives of players have said openly to anybody that would listen problems with their loved ones on football teams, basketball teams, baseball teams, whatever. But now there's a larger way to do it. Instead of telling people in the neighborhood that your son's unhappy with his playing time, now you get to tell the whole world your son's unhappy with whatever circumstance he's got on his team. I mean, again, I get Dak Prescott absolutely 100% getting ripped. This is what we do to quarterbacks. They're doing it in Buffalo. This is the third day now where we've had, is Josh Allen to blame for the loss in Kansas City? Right? I mean, they're little fun conversations because the quarterback is at the center of everything. The quarterback, you can give up 40 points on your defense. You can be as porous as you want. You can allow 50-yard touchdown passes and a guy to shred you for 185 on the ground. But the quarterback is supposed to score one more point than your defense allows. That's his job. Go out there and figure it out. We give up a touchdown, you get a touchdown right back. We just gave up a field goal, you get a touchdown to give us the lead. And when you don't do that, you get criticized. Even if you've had an awesome game, you threw for 400, four touchdowns, no interceptions. You lose, you still lose. Dak Prescott is to blame for the Dallas Cowboys' loss to the Green Bay Packers. He looked tight. He was throwing over people's heads. He threw a pick six. He not until late in the game when it was far out of reach did they even have a semblance of an efficient offense. But how much of that was Green Bay just going, let's not get crazy here, let's not go nuts, let's not give them a quick, easy score to get back into this. If they can get some yardage, fine, but let's get that clock down so that they can, this requires them to use up some clock. They got into a two-score game. There was that possibility of getting the ball and getting an onside kick and all that, but in the end, it was way, way too late. And Dak was at fault for that. But if you are seeing this with the families, right, it means, at least means to me, that at some point these individuals have spoken about their distrust or their dislike or something about the team privately to loved ones that these loved ones thought could be public information. That's what I'm wondering. Because if you're Jerry Jones and you're 81, 82 years old, you got to go to somebody in your brain trust, get down there and end this right now. I don't need this offseason. I don't need Terrence Parsons telling the world that my quarterback needs to take a team-friendly deal. That's between me and my quarterback. I don't need Micah's brother dictating what we're going to do this offseason. And I certainly don't need CeeDee Lamb's mom telling the world he's angry at his QB.
This is Wake Up Call on the SportsMap Radio Network. Alongside Ron Culver, here's Tony D.
All right, thanks for joining us. Alex Gold, our good friend in Kansas City, is going to join us, host of Cody and Gold on 610 Sports, to talk about the Chiefs as we continue previewing teams. I did get a request from Robert in South Korea, who likes to hit the show up every now and then, if we are going to try to get Bonte Hill on the show to talk 49ers. Now, we've said this before. Bonte, he does a show when we do a show.
Yeah.
And so he's been very difficult for us to get.
The only way we could do it is if we record it ahead of time.
Right.
Now he is live.
When we're on at the same time, yeah, in San Francisco. Now he said, are you going to get the guy that called you Charlie on to talk about the thing? And that's Bonte Hill's
claim.
I
would love to. I always think of him first. It's just hard to coordinate because, yeah, we would have to record anything with him just because he is live.
But he's so good. He's so energetic. I don't know how he does. My wife said to me one time, she goes, why is it that, she goes, you wake up in the morning and within a couple of minutes, you're just singing. You're just singing a song. And I go, a lot of it is I have things in my head. Like I have songs in my head. Sometimes I just sing for no reason. I said, but a lot of it is to clear my morning voice. Like I don't want to start the day. Like I gotta get the vocals going. And sometimes I just sing silly pop song lyrics. Bonte Hill must sing like a concert because he gets like as soon we call him up at like 5 o'clock in the morning, San Francisco time.
Well,
and he's on fire the second he comes on.
I like to imagine when we get him on that he's riding BART. Now BART, you know, the subway system in San Francisco, and that he is just going a mile a minute and that he's entertaining the people in BART.
Right, just as a warm-up act.
He very well may be driving, but I want to imagine that he is, you know, he's kind of position people saying, guys, I'm going to be on a phone call in a few seconds. Let it rip.
Yeah, yeah. Because I had a co-host years and years and years ago. I had a co-host, and we used to do a morning show, and our show started at 6 o'clock in the morning, and every morning he would complain how tired he was. Like, that was his shtick every morning. And I'd be starting the show, going. You go, I got to wake up first. And we had a consultant come in and go, never do that. Never do that. Nobody cares that you're tired. Everybody's tired. Nobody cares you're tired. And he must have gotten that memo because he's always electrifying when he talks. So we'll try. But, again, schedules are schedules and they're really hard to do. All right. Nevertheless, we will talk to Alex Gold in Kansas City about the Chiefs. Now, I'm going to ask him this flat out. I think that this is... Right now, Patrick Mahomes, it's hard to define, but so far, because your best playoff run is when you win the Super Bowl. No matter if you're number one seed, home field advantage through the playoffs, best record, all the other stuff, best weapons, best offense. If you win the Super Bowl, you've done it. That's your best run. But compared to other runs that he has had that have led to a Super Bowl title, how impressive is this for Patrick Mahomes? I mean, in the end, aren't we just talking about one game? I mean, they beat the Dolphins on a freezer night game. They beat a Dolphins team that where the weather was as a factor as they were. But let's be honest, this is not the same level Chiefs team that we've seen in the past. And yet they found a way to go to Buffalo and beat Buffalo. And, you know, a game that I hate to admit this because I really bought into the Bills. I kept thinking to myself the entire game, the Bills are going to win this. I just did. Even when Kansas City had the lead, all of that, even the Bills will get a win in this. This is going to be a wild ending and they're going to win it. And Kansas City emerged on top. So we'll talk to Alex Gold about that. Baseball note, the Hall of Fame induction ceremony. Three people will be inducted from yesterday's voting. It is Adrian Beltre, one of the greatest third basemen of all time. Just an absolute fantastic third baseman that was a power hitter for a number of teams, including the Dodgers and the Texas Rangers. He is going to the Hall of Fame. Joe Mauer spent his entire season in Minnesota as catcher of the Twins. He is going to the Hall of Fame. And Todd Helton, who spent his entire career with the Colorado Rockies. Many people thought Todd Helton wouldn't get in because the Coors Field factor is a thing.
Yeah.
And that is a thing. And his numbers obviously skewed playing at altitude and whatnot, but he did get in. This was not a first-time vote. It took a little bit for Todd Helton to get in. He did suffer of previous people that got votes. So just to reiterate, in case you don't know, and I know many of you do, but let me do this for people who don't know, how you vote for the Hall of Fame is you get a ballot of players that are eligible, and you get to pick 10. You do not have to vote for 10. You could have one. You could vote for one person and say, that's all I want. You can vote 7. You can vote 6. You can vote 5. But the most you can vote for on a ballot is 10. So sometimes a player is on a ballot where it's loaded with Hall of Famers. And they go, you just caught a bad break. You know, some people are just like, you got to get 75 and it's got to be a pure 75. 74.9, you're not in. 75.0, you're in. So that's how it works. They're not rounding up in your favor. That's basically how that works.
Beltre to me was a no-brainer.
No-brainer. Joe Mauer, the same thing.
But Joe
Mauer. Great numbers for Joe Mauer.
But Joe Mauer just got in.
I thought he was going to get in, and he got in. Yeah, I thought he was going to get in.
He finished at 76%.
Todd Helton, I was really curious.
I
covered Todd Helton, and I got the question many, many times when I was doing sports radio in Colorado and Colorado Springs in Denver about Todd Helton going to the Hall of Fame. And naturally, you're talking to a fan base that is so biased, right, that is so more in tune to the guy's effective career and what he meant to the team and what he meant to the organization, that you're not really getting a full picture nationally of how people think about Todd Helton. The fact that the Rockies barely made the postseason during his career, the fact that they did go to a World Series, got swept by the Red Sox, but there's not a huge postseason body of work there. For a good portion of the latter part of Helton's career, he was paired up with a bunch of young people that, you know, were trying to, you know, they were trying to save money on salary because they had overspent on Danny Nagel and Mike Hampton, two pitchers that didn't work out in Colorado. So they decided to fill the roster with young talent from the minors, but keep the stalwart Todd Helton at first base. But the Coors Field factor is a thing. When I first got to Colorado, they explained it to me when I was in that press box. I remember sitting next to real baseball guys, and they explained to me the humidor, and they explained to me how the field is bigger because of the altitude and how it affects some dimensions of the park and all of that. And he said the humidor is supposed to get the runs down, but there were games to be like 16 to 14 because the ball just flies out of the park. But I'm glad he's in. I was borderline whether or not he was a surefire. He wasn't a surefire Hall of Famer in my book. Like if you had me to choose between Helton or Maurer, you know, I chose Maurer. But I'm glad he's in. I'm glad he's in. Because the Rockies don't have a real rich history since arriving in this league, but he's the main one. He's the number one guy. He's Mr. Colorado Rocky. Larry Walker was somebody else before he arrived and became a Blake Street Bomber, right? Players have come and gone in Colorado history. There are Hall of Famers who once wore a Colorado Rockies hat, but Todd Helton's going in with the Colorado Rockies hat because that's the team.
Dante Bichette, he's not in, right?
Dante Bichette, I don't think is in.
Yeah.
But Larry Walker got in. Now, Larry Walker, you know, I remember when he got traded to St. Louis. Larry Walker was a big Rocky, so you know, and I remember everyone being really sad. He was sad to leave Denver, but he was going to the Cardinals where he was going to win, and that was the deal with Helton too. In 2007, there was a real conversation about trading Todd Helton to the Red Sox. It was a real deal. People wanted it to happen in Colorado. They were sick and tired of that organization wasting that guy's talent. And the Rockies were trash. And Todd Helton was there every day playing first base with a bunch of kids going absolutely nowhere, one of the worst teams in baseball, and people were saying he deserves better than this. Put him in later in his career. Put him on the Red Sox. Let him win a championship. Let him get a ring. Let him get something. And for whatever reason in 2007, the Rockies didn't pull that trigger. And to be honest with you, even though it didn't end up a championship and the team he would have been traded to ended up winning a championship that would have given him a ring, I think Helton got a lot out of that postseason run, even though it didn't result in a banner. Because to watch that team, they won 14 of their final 15 games in September to make it to the playoffs. And then when they got to the playoffs, they had a one-game playoff with San Diego, and they won that game. And they got him in the postseason. When they got in the postseason, they took care of Philadelphia, Arizona, and then got swept by the Red Sox. And Todd Helton was, you know, him catching the baseball of that NLCS, of them knowing they were going to the World Series, and his celebratory picture was a big deal. But Adrian Beltre, I want to talk about him for a second. There are great third basemen in this league. Brooks Robinson comes to mind. Mike Schmidt comes to mind. There's a number of George Brett comes to mind. Adrian Beltre is on the list as one of the greatest third basemen in Major League Baseball history.
Yeah.
He is as high on that list as those other guys that you know.
Which is weird to think or hard
really
to think.
It really is.
Because of how many great third bases. Like that, usually a lot of the great players were third basemen.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But he was as good as it gets. A reliable hitter, fantastic fielder, fielder.
And I might say he might be the funniest third baseman.
That's right.
Because those videos probably certainly helped his candidacy, but they are so fun to watch.
5 gold gloves, over 400 home runs, 3,000 hits, just absolute fantastic player. Glad that he's going to Cooperstown along with, again, Joe Maurer, stalwart behind the plate for the Minnesota Twins. We'll talk to Alex Gold about the Chiefs next.
Wake Up Call with Tony D and Ron Culver continues now on the Sports Map Radio Network. Here's Tony D and Ron Culver.
All right, we're going to be heading to the Progressive Guest Line. Alex Gold, our good friend from Cody and Gold, 6:10 a.m. in Kansas City on the Chiefs, heading to Baltimore this weekend. Progressive Insurance, drivers who switch and save with Progressive save nearly $750 on average. Call or click today and find out how we could save you hundreds on your car insurance. So again, look at the way this Chiefs team is, right? Okay, so they didn't win the AFC. They weren't the number one seed. They weren't even the number two seed, right? But they were a team that had a lot of ups and downs this season, and there was a lot of points this year where you were like, eh, this doesn't feel like the same Kansas City Chiefs team. But that's okay. That happens. That happens to everybody. We did it with the Patriots, right? Not every year can you dominate and look great and have a high-powered offense and all of that. You got to find ways to get in. But there was a period of time. I mean, they looked bad on Christmas Day against Las Vegas. And you're like, yeah, this is a 9-6 football team that doesn't let – now they're in the AFC Championship once again. Alex Gold, Cody and Gold on 610 AM in Kansas City joins us on a Progressive Guest Line. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. You know, I get to talk to you a lot, you know, this time
yeah.
of year.
I love that. We love that. Maybe one day we'll get you on for Royals talk, you know, because something's going to happen with them. I figure something's going to pop
you know
with
what?
Them.
We could have a longer conversation sometime. I actually think this year they have a chance because of how bad the division is and some of these moves where I got them at 30-1 about a month ago to win the AL Central, and it's down to 10-1. So
oh, no,
I kind of
okay.
like the value.
If that happens, you know you're coming back on here, man. You know you're coming back on here. I'm trying to compartmentalize this question because we're not at the Super Bowl. We're not talking about a championship run yet. But people are kind of wanting to know, is this the most impressive run that the Chiefs have been on? I would think that would belong to a Super Bowl title. But how do you look at where they are right now to where they were a couple of weeks ago in the regular season to close it out?
Well, I certainly think for it to be, you know, the most, you know, impressive season, at minimum, they got to get to the Super Bowl. So I'm
right.
with you. I think they've got to at least get to Vegas for that to come into play. But when you consider, as you were mentioning, where this team was on Christmas Day and that loss to the Raiders, and now here they are in an AFC title game, it is awfully impressive. You know, Tom Brady had plenty of seasons where we would all watch the Patriots and were like, they're not even that good, but this guy just found a way to get to an AFC title game, to get to a Super Bowl, and it was frustrating for everybody else around the NFL. And I imagine that's the same feeling a lot of people are having now watching Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs, because we know they're not the same offense, but yet here they are. And a lot of it has to do with the defense, which has been just incredible throughout the season. And they finally realized, you know, Tony, who they are on offense. Stop trying to be the 2021, 2022 offense. And instead, be who they are, which is not as explosive. Lean into Pacheco. Lean into Rice and Kelce. Stop trying to make Kadarius Toney something he's not. And I think all of that is why they find themselves in another AFC title game.
And when they were 6-1, everything's kind of cruising along. But when did these issues come up? When did we start really talking about dropped passes, changing up an idea? They're more vulnerable than ever before. When did that conversation start creeping in?
So I don't think people really acknowledged it and thought it was a season-long problem, probably until right before that Philadelphia Eagles game. But when did these issues, you know, come to light? You could argue week one, we just didn't know it was a season-long problem. Go back to that Detroit Lions game where Kadarius Toney drops the ball, pops it up in the air. It's a pick six. Really, that's the difference in the game. Otherwise, the Chiefs probably win. They didn't have Chris Jones or Travis Kelce playing, but still some of those turnovers – those were happening all early in the year. We just thought, okay, those are, you know, that's just something they would get over. But that's who they are. I mean, look, they just did it against Buffalo. They just were fortunate enough to still win. They had a red zone turnover, Mecole Hardman right at the goal line. So, I mean, they still made those mistakes. The difference is so far in the postseason, they've been able to overcome them.
You made a great point, which is if you go into the Patriots, I felt after that game when I was kind of dissecting this win, it felt very Brady with not the best Patriots team win. It was like you have Buffalo that has been gearing up for this, been waiting to get this game in Buffalo, been waiting to get an opportunity like this where maybe the Chiefs were a little less than they were before, and yet the Kansas City Chiefs found a way. Patriots did it for a long time. Not every year in that 20 years were they the superior team by a mile. There were teams who really felt they could beat New England, and then in the end they shake their heads going, We didn't. In the end, though, how did they beat Buffalo? At what point did you – what is the big characteristic of that team that got them that win? What was the turning point for them in that win?
Yeah, I mean, I think for the Chiefs, it's this defense that probably still doesn't get enough attention. And you look at the second half, and you look at the second half of their last, I think it's now five games, and I believe they have not given up more than 7 points in any second half over the last five games or so, something like that. And so that, to me, is the swing. The defense finally had answers to slow down what looked like an unstoppable rushing attack from Buffalo. And I still don't know why Buffalo got away from the run late. If you think about that final drive, they couldn't help themselves. They were still taking some shots down the field. I'm convinced that they would have just kept running with Cook and Allen. I think they bleed the clock down and they get either a touchdown or, you know, at least they get a closer field goal attempt and maybe the game goes to overtime or whatever. I thought that was a mistake from Buffalo. But it's this defense. You know, they don't force a ton of takeaways, which is maybe why people don't give them the same props as they do the Ravens defense, because the Ravens do turn people over more. But I think that's what it is. It's this defense, because even though offensively the Chiefs were moving the ball, you know, they went away from Pacheco late in the game. I thought that they should have continued to stick with him. They still weren't willing to do that. And you know, when you get doubled up on plays, the Bills ran double the plays the Chiefs did. I mean, it's pretty impressive to put up 27 points and only have the ball, I think it was for less than 25 minutes.
When you look at that Chiefs defense, we're talking about the number two scoring defense in the NFL, but the Ravens are the number one scoring defense in the NFL. But Chiefs defense against Lamar Jackson, how do you envision that? How do you see the way Kansas City is set up to deal with that, what he can do offensively, running and throwing?
So I do think this is a low-scoring game. I mean, this could be one that's in the teens or the low 20s. I think both defenses are going to be able to limit these offenses. The key to watch, honestly, around the Lamar Jackson front for Kansas City is going to be the health of their linebacker, Willie Gay, who's their most athletic linebacker. He's their spy, and he got hurt in the game against Josh Allen, and it impacted that. He was hurt with a neck injury heading into it, and that's what he has right now, and that's going to be, I think, a huge injury to watch all week long. And if they don't have him, that is a big loss to try to limit Lamar Jackson. The other one on the offensive side will just be Joe Tooney, the left guard who's got a pec strain. So those are the two big injuries. But how do you slow down Lamar? I think, like, he's shown he can pass. I think we're long past the, the guy can't throw the football ridiculousness. But I do still think you would prefer him to pass, right? Like, I think you still want to make him do that. But easier said than done. I just think that the Chiefs tend to buckle down in the big spots this year. So that's why I think it's a lower scoring game. If you told me either team won, you know, 17-14 or 20-17, I would not be surprised.
How is Kansas City as a blitzing team? That's always been kind of the thing with Lamar Jackson. You can beat him with blitzes. Houston tried it in the first half. He adjusted. But that's always been kind of the thing with Lamar. You can get him with blitzing. Is this a blitzing defense?
Absolutely. That's Steve Spagnuolo, the Chiefs defensive coordinator. I mean, that he's done that his entire career. He's one of the best at, you know, disguising blitzes and making, as I mentioned, the second half numbers, making second half adjustments. So, oh yeah, they're going to come after Lamar. The question is just in what way and how does he disguise it? They love to blitz Trent McDuffie or Legarius Sneed, their two corners. So there will be something with that throughout the game. You know, to what extent, it'll be interesting to see the percentage. But I'm sure that'll be part of the game plan. It has to be. It just has to be for the Chiefs to have a chance to win.
There's one angle to this game that I'm really curious. You've got Andy Reid, who's a very, very savvy offensive mind. Patrick Mahomes, one of the more brilliant quarterbacks at dissecting things that he sees. And then there's Mike McDonald on the other side, this young quarterback that's getting a lot of run and a lot of attention, taking over for Wink Martindale and what he's done to that Ravens defense. How do you view this matchup between guys who have been here before, knows everything you could throw at you, and a kid who's been getting a lot of run is what he's done for that defense and what he's calling?
Yeah, McDonald's going to be a head coach here very, very soon.
Very soon.
I think no question, whether it's this offseason or maybe he decides to handpick it next offseason and he can be the Ben Johnson of next year's coaching cycle. But yeah, I mean, look, it's a tall challenge for Andy Reid. I think, again, when you asked me earlier about how this team got here, I think the difference now is the Chiefs have been able to, you know, they've got these diamond formation they've been starting to do. They've been able to, you know, Travis Kelce has played well enough the last 2 weeks that I think now you've got to continue to give him all the attention, which is opening things up for Rashee Rice. And so I think if you're McDonald, what do you do with Rashee Rice? Like, you know about Travis Kelce, but how do you handle the drag routes where that's been the bread and butter for Rashee Rice? And can you have success getting after Mahomes, something that the Dolphins, something the Bills did not do? The Chiefs left and right tackle had struggled all year. They had not been good, but they both have played really, really well the last 2 weeks. Does that continue? Donovan Smith, Jonathan Taylor. That's why Patrick Mahomes has had more success too here as of late. Is they've done a great job protecting him.
Alex Gold, always good catching up with you, my friend. Enjoy the weekend. Hope to catch up with you soon, my friend. Good talking to you.
Hey, thanks, Tony.
You got it. Alex Gold, Cody and Gold, 610 a.m. in Kansas City. Does a great job for us covering the Chiefs. And we, again, he, like he said, we talk to him a lot this time of year because that's exactly where Kansas City is. We will continue. It's Wake Up Call on Sports Map Radio.